Hi there, you're with The Big Country on RN. I'm Edwina Farley. Coming up on today's program, we'll meet a shearing team with lots of experience. Their average age is 75. Korean students learn some Australian horse riding skills, and locals in one of Australia's hottest towns keep fit and active playing a version of indoor cricket outdoors. One of those wielding the bat is Marble Bar local Ema.
When you're younger, like, the heat doesn't really affect you. We used to run around like crazy. People run around with bare feet on, you know, the hot tar.
They breathe them tough in Marble Bar.
Breathe them tough, yeah. Not anymore. No, no, after 5 years in Perth, shoes on.
I think it's an age thing, actually. But I tell you, I'd be keeping my shoes on too if the mercury hits the high 40s. Cricket played Pilbara style later in the show. First up, though, something special for the collectors. We're talking big, big machines.
I guess I like the history of them. I like the challenge of restoring them. It's not glorifying war or anything like that, or war gaming. It's more about the tribute to the people, the men and women that made them in the late 30s, early 40s, and the task that they played in giving everybody the freedom that they now enjoy.
Now, you've probably heard of paddock bashers before, bummy old run-down vehicles that you don't mind driving across rough country. Well, today I came across the ultimate paddock basher, a former World War II tank rumbling across Matt McMahon's farm near Oberon in the central west of New South Wales. Hello, I'm Melanie Pearce. These old tanks were snapped up by farmers at the end of the war when heavy machinery like bulldozers was hard to come by. Like many farmers across the country, Matt's dad used this one to clear paddocks and build dams on the property.
What have we got here?
Mate, this is a Matilda Mark IIA infantry tank made by the British in 39 and 40, served throughout the Second World War, and came to Australia probably in the mid-40s, and served with the Australian Army then up until the 50s when they were sold off to farmers. They started selling them in the late 40s and they sold them right through until the mid-50s at MOD auctions, and they were sold all over Australia. But sometimes I've read stories of people getting a whole row of them for 50 quid, and farmers bought them because they were a good, powerful bulldozer at the time. They take them home and modify them and take the turret off and then modify the structure, similar to the one we got down the shed there, and use them for bulldozers. And this particular vehicle, my father bought it in 1974 or 72, it might have been, and it had a cable blade on it and was used for land clearing here. All this country to our right here that's now pine forest was all scrub, and that was all cleared with this vehicle. And then my father bought proper bulldozers, and I inherited the old tank basically, and we've been working on the damn thing ever since. We've got five of these Matildas, and we've got a Centurion, and we've got three Bren gun carriers and several hundred ton of assorted spares.
How significant to farming in Australia were these post-World War II tanks?
I think they were very significant to the farming community across Australia because the army had an enormous amount of them. And when they were sold off in the late 40s and early 50s, bulldozers were very hard to come by and very expensive. So you could go to an auction and buy a vehicle like this, and it'd be the most powerful vehicle on your property, and you could pull scrub and do all those sorts of things that are now not so politically correct to do. Bulldozers and that type of machinery really didn't become available until after around the time when the Snowy Mountains scheme finished, when that sort of equipment was brought in for that job. It was then sold on to farmers and they had the opportunity to buy proper equipment. A normal bulldozer would cost you in the vicinity of £300 or £400, whereas you could pick one of these up for 25 quid. You know, so you could get four or five of them if you wanted to, and a lot of people did. But it just gave everybody a good opportunity to buy a good, cheap, solid vehicle. And the fact that a lot of them are still running today, almost 75 years after they were made, is a tribute to their design and longevity, I guess.
Now, Matt is not alone in his fascination with old tanks and military machines. He's got a group of mates who help keep these monsters moving.
How much do you love tinkering with tanks?
Yeah, we tinker a lot, actually, because for the little bit of driving you do, there's an enormous amount of maintenance required. So you can imagine there's a lot of moving parts and fairly technical. This vehicle's got twin engines, We've often had them out on the ground, giving them a bit of a once-over. It's a full-time job. Luckily, we've got a big crew of blokes that assist us. Yeah.
What's your group called?
Mate, the group here is a loose association of friends and acquaintances. It's called Batrack International, and that's the Busted Arse Tank Repairs & Co. And if we're not working on tanks, we're usually working on farms, farm machinery, or marking calves, or lambs, or doing something. Yeah, so there's always something to do. Now, this is a very early Matilda tank. This was built by Fowlers in London, in England, and it was built prior to September 1939, and it's one of very few Matilda tanks in Australia that were built without an emergency hatch in the floor. And this one, during the Second World War, when the Australians had control of it, it was actually converted into a bulldozer. And there are only three bulldozers left in existence, original army bulldozers. And we're in the process of restoring this one. We've got a fully rebuilt engine in it, and we're on track to hopefully get it going. So it'll, and when it is running, it'll be the only Matilda dozer in the world that's in operational condition. And it'll be something to behold. We'll have a decent barbecue that day.
They're pretty expensive to run.
This one's not too bad. This one uses about 6 gallons an hour in diesel. We've got one down the shed there that'll use 13 litres of petrol for every 100 yards. So economically, this one's probably the most economical one we own. You've got to remember, these vehicles were built at a time when the fastest thing on the battlefield was a horse. In top gear, this thing's still only doing 15 miles an hour. So in the main gears that you'd use while you're on the battlefront around is just walking pace, because they didn't need a vehicle that outrun the troops on the ground, or in fact a horse. So, when these things were in service during the Second World War, everything was done with, ammunition, and everything was still dragged around by teams of horses. But they had a very good service history. These vehicles went into service when war broke out in France in 1939, and they were still used by the Australian Army up until 1954 with the CMF. So they had the longest service history of any armoured vehicle in Australian history, or if not English history. So says something about the manner in which how they were made and maintained, I guess.
Now, obviously, they can't fire any guns anymore.
Yeah, no, the armament's been disarmed, and that was done when the army sold them. So they're all inert; they don't fire. None of our vehicles have got live guns on. So yeah, it's basically purely for show. This one's a 40mm. Anti-tank gun. It was the Duck's Guts in 1939, but it quickly became a pop gun.
Do you still use it for farming at all?
No, it's only a plaything. We get them out and bang around the paddock and that sort of thing. We might pull a tractor out or something that gets bogged, but we don't do much farming with it anymore.
How much of your dad is in this tank?
Well, I think there's a lot of dad in it. Dad had it for a long time, and dad cleared a lot of scrubby. Cleared 1,000 acres of scrubby with it and dug a lot of dams. That dam down there in front of us there was dug by this tank when it had a cable blade on it. So it was something Dad really enjoyed, and he was very passionate about as well. We're just keeping on the tradition, I guess.
Do you respect these vehicles?
We respect these vehicles immensely, because it's a tribute to the people that fought in them during the Second World War. And after those guys are all dead and gone, these vehicles will be still around. And I think the enthusiasts that have got these vehicles, the collectors that restore military vehicles, are basically holding on to the history of it. And in a lot of respects, I think if collectors or passionate people didn't have these vehicles and haven't been in a running condition, they'd be all lost.
To your poles. Good, nice and steady. Steady, good. Look up to your poles. Bring her back to trot. Steady.
A group of high school students is being put through a series of horse riding drills at a stud near Ipswich in southern Queensland. They're a long way from home.
Good. Now leave your cones and canter back up around the poles. Yep, go for a canter. Around.
Hello, I'm Jodie Gunders. These 16 and 17-year-old students are from a high school in South Korea. They're in Queensland to get some intensive training in the Australian horse industry. Holly Perrin is putting them through their training paces today.
Yeah, so we've got the students from the Korean Horsemen's High School here. They're doing a course in general horse management and trackwork riding. They've come over here, they've got their general riding skills and horse management, but, you know, they've got that in Korean. So now they've had to come to Australia and learn all the terminology in English and learn the way that we do things over here.
What differences are they noticing between how horsework is done in Korea and in Australia?
So in Korea, they don't have a lot of what we call horsemanship. So in Australia here, we do a lot of groundwork with our horses and, you know, make sure that they're, you know, safe before we get on them and that they're responsive. So we've been doing a lot of horsemanship with them. They've been doing float loading, lots of lunging and mouthing of horses, even the off the trackers. They're coming in and, you know, mouthing them before they get on them. So, and they've found a big difference in the size of the horses. Like, they have very small horses in Korea compared to the large horses that we have, you know, in Australia.
Ojin Saw is the only English speaker in the group and is keen to talk about the experience.
Riding in the basic stable clinic, and the big thing was natural horsemanship. It was really good.
What's different about the horse industry in Korea and in Australia?
The big difference is our grade is 2, and Australia is grade 1, and we only have 20,000 horses in Korea, but in Australia there are a lot, so there's a big difference. And we don't have strict safety rules like here. Yeah.
Would you like to come back to Australia to work with horses?
Sure. I want to come back immediately when I go back to Korea, and after my graduation, I want to come back.
Good. That's it. Well done.
These Korean students are in Australia as guests of Queensland's agricultural training colleges. They're hoping this training program, which has been 2 years in the planning, will gain international recognition. Casey Delaney is the Executive Director of Education and Training.
The equine industry in Korea is fairly precise and mostly racing and thoroughbred, whereas the exposure that they're getting out here is more broad and across all the other aspects. So there's some pre-training riding, there's increasing their riding, there's stabling and handling, there's some rehabilitation stuff as well. But they also then get 4 weeks of work experience with different studs around the area.
And you're saying before that what we can offer in Australia is real world experience. What do you mean by that?
I guess that it's out, it's hands-on, it's practical, and it's what they're being exposed to, a location that actually participates in all those areas of equine industry. So it's not in a clinical type environment that's removed from the practical.
Back at the stud, training is done for the day and Ojin Saw is leading his horse back to the stables. So how did that feel to be able to ride around today?
It was very hot. Exciting today, yeah. I did make horse steady and gentle today. We usually go to the track, but today we learned how to make horse steady. Yeah.
In the stables, Ojin's last job is to wash down the horse.
If we don't wash horses, the horse can get infection and it causes disease, and it's not looking good when you don't give them a shower.
Do you like this particular horse?
Yeah, I love this horse. Yeah.
What's its name?
His name is Great, and she's 6 years old, and she's a lovely horse.
And she was a racehorse?
Yeah, she was a racehorse. She was a very small racehorse, but very good horse for me.
Korean student Ojin Saw obviously enjoying his experience riding in Australia. He was speaking there with Jodie Gunders. You're listening to A Big Country here on RN. Still to come today, we're keeping fit and active in a hot climate and a shearing team with lots of experience.
How are you?
Hello, how are you?
My name is Neville Swiker, just a shearer I am, and I'm 66 years of age.
Frank Arbellini, a wool classer, and I'm 82.
Trevor McIntosh, and I'm the farm owner, and I'm 84, coming up 85.
I'm Dennis James, rouse about, and I'm 77.
And collectively, how old is that?
308 years.
Give or take one, because we've got a couple of halves in there.
Yeah.
Sitting on a bale of wool, Neville, Trevor, Dennis and Frank wipe the sweat from their brow. They're enjoying a well-earned beer, having shorn the last of 1,163 sheep on this farm near Denmark, in the great southern of Western Australia.
That's it, Trevor. Done. Yeah, very good.
Hello, I'm Tyne Logan. Trevor McIntosh didn't mean to employ a shearing team with an average age of 75. It just turned out that way when his regular shearer pulled out at the last minute. So how did you all get together as a shearing team? Is this a regular thing or is this a once-off?
Well, just it's annual shearing, and we have Trevor's, and this is the team that's made up the numbers to get the sheep shorn on this year. Collectively, we don't always work together, but I've worked with Neville on a number of occasions over previous years. Dennis is the newcomer, the young fellow at the end. He's the new chap.
I'm the apprentice. Yeah. I am the apprentice. Yeah. Dennis.
the apprentice at how many years apprentice?
Well, this time it's only been a week with Frank, but over the years I've worked on quite a few farms.
Yeah, you'd be going on a good, 30-year apprenticeship?
Oh, easy. Yes, easy. Yeah.
God, you think that they'd promote you somewhere along the line?
Oh, yeah, mate, I've been wishful thinking, you know. Just biding me time.
At 66, Neville is the baby of the team. He started shearing when he was 18, and 48 years later is still in the game. It's got to be hard on you physically.
Oh, it probably is a little bit, but it keeps me fit. I was 14 stone when I was 14, and I'm still 14 stone, so there's a lot of people can't boast that.
How many sheep could you shear in a day?
Now, probably about 160, 70.
Not saying you're old, but how do you stand up against the young guns?
Oh, they're all young blokes. Yeah, they shear in front of me. Yeah, there's no doubt about that. I mean, it's just common sense that as you get older, you get slower.
But more experienced?
But I can keep them fairly honest most of the time.
It's not all been smooth sailing for the men in the team. Between them, they've had four knee reconstructions. A double knee reconstruction for Neville, and the same as well for Frank. For a moment there, it was something that 82-year-old Frank Garbellini thought would mark the end of his career.
It was a mental thing when my knees went on me. I thought, oh, gee, I'm doomed. I won't be able to do any more wall classing and that. But I set a new knees and I'm back on deck.
And Frank, you actually wrote a bit about that knee reconstruction in a poem as well, didn't you?
I put a little bit of a poem together. Now, these old knees don't carry me strongly no more, and distance is a mission beyond the garage door. Wool rooms I once trod by heart are cobwebbed in my mind. The busy shed, the fastest team, I've somehow left behind. The teams don't camp out anymore the way they used to. Cranky cooks and quarters are fast becoming history too. They've given way to travel at the whims of mobile men. Once gone, their colourful past simply won't be seen again.
It's excellent.
Starting as a rouseabout at age 13, Frank has seen a lot of changes. He's seen the numbers dwindle, females enter into the shearing arenas, and he's seen mulesing be introduced.
But I think probably the biggest change is the wide comb. It gives you a greater, rate of dispatch on a day for a shearer.
How much of a difference?
Oh, well, I would say 40 sheep, 40, 50 sheep, at least 50 sheep.
So at age 66 and 82, and Dennis, for you, 78, will you ever leave the industry?
Oh, just keep on going. Well, Frank's never left it, so I can't see any rush for me to go away.
These days, I'm sort of strictly one stand, two stand sheds, and I can cope. I can handle that pretty well. And you get the job done, and it's a breeze, really. And it's a challenge which I enjoy.
It's evening in Marble Bar, a town in Western Australia's East Pilbara that prides itself on being the country's hottest town. Hello, I'm Eliza Wood, and I'm at the basketball courts where the locals are playing indoor cricket outdoors. There's a lot of sledging and arguing too. And in a place where the temperature regularly hits the high 40s,
It's not easy to keep up with a normal exercise program.
My name's Lawrence Wobat, commonly known as Wombat, and I work at the Mines Department. But tonight we got some of the community together for a game of cricket.
With all the squabbling that was going on, Lawrence, I couldn't work out what was going on. What are the rules?
We make them up as we go along, but usually it's like indoor cricket rules. So there's two batsmen, and they usually have three or four overs each, depending on how many turn up. After they have three or four overs each, they go off and the next pair of batsmen come on. So if the batsman hit a ball into the back net, it's four runs. If hit it in the back net on the full, it's six runs. If hit it over the fence, it's minus 10 runs. We used to have a rule that they had to go and get the ball too, but it's a bit too dark at night. And you're lazy.
Righto, team sorted, let's go.
Another one, there's six.
How long have you been playing for here at Marble Bar?
It's been a couple of months now. So, yeah, like about 10 weeks.
Why'd it start?
Mainly to get people out and about and a bit of a community thing. Just enjoy yourself, you know, spend a bit of energy after work, and it's not too hot now.
So over the last couple of months, how have your indoor cricket players been going, do you think? Are they improving, getting into it?
The sledging's improving. They're improving slowly, especially the ladies.
The boys aren't.
The boys always think they're good, but I especially like seeing the ladies play because each week they improve. And so that gives them a bit of confidence to play a bit more, and yeah, they go really well. But it's just good for everyone to get out and join in, have a bit of fun.
Run, run, run! Go, 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 go! One more!
Hello, what's your name?
I'm Millie.
Millie, hi Millie. How'd you go tonight?
I think I did well. I sucked at bowling, but apart from that, I think I did all right.
So what do you do in Marble Bar?
I mainly hang out with my friends. I work, help my mum at the shop, and I go walking everywhere, basically.
Have you lived here a long time?
I've lived here my whole life.
Do you like it here?
Yeah, I do. It's very peaceful. Like, in Perth, it's very, like, everyone's up in their grill. But here in Marble Bar, like, it's just chilled.
So you go to school in Perth?
Yeah, I do.
Home for the hottest part of the year. What do you get up to during your holidays?
Swimming, sleeping, eating and watching movies.
Five, one,
so we're just
three.
Adding up the scores here to see who lost.
Eight, one.
The person who's counting it works at the shop and we get overcharged all the time, so I'm unsure.
What's your name?
Ema.
How did you go tonight, Ema?
Oh yeah, I think I played pretty.
Gee, you guys good.
Pretty all right.
Have you been working on your cricket skills?
Oh, not really. Sort of. Come down.
There was a fair bit of technique in your bowling.
Nah, it's just me mucking around, really.
What do you do in Marble Bar?
I work in the shop, my family business.
You've lived here all your life, have you?
Yeah, since I was five. Did 5 years of boarding and then I start uni. So.
What are you doing at uni?
Midwifery.
Ah. Do you get much chance to exercise in Marble Bar?
Well, when you're younger, like, the heat doesn't really affect you. So when we were younger, we used to run around like crazy. Didn't even realise it was the heat of the day. Just used to it. People running around with bare feet on, you know, the hot tar. And I just sit there now and go, oh, no thanks.
They breathe them tough in Marble Bar.
Breathe us tough, yeah. Not anymore. No, after 5 years in Perth, shoes on. Like, growing up, we didn't really have much. No, there wasn't really much sport. So this is... the cricket, we've all just sort of decided, we're like, all right, let's just do it.
Or you could put it that side. Or you could put it that side.
And that's Marble Bar local Ema ending that report from Eliza Wood in the Pilbara. A little bit of hot weather isn't stopping them keeping fit and active. Good to hear it. You can see some of those shots of the team in action at abc.net.au/radionational. Thanks to Brendan O'Neill for technical production this week. Don't forget, if you're finding the program hard to catch, you can join us anytime via the ABC Radio Player app, or just find us via the RN homepage. I'm Edwina Farley. Talk soon.